Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm very happy to have as my guest today Joyce Carol Oates, a longtime friend and a longtime friend of Bookworm, and she has edited a book called Prison Noir. It's part of the series from Akashic. There are more than 60 volumes now. There's New Jersey Noir, which she also edited. Noir is eating the world. I was once very defensive about noir because I thought, well, I wanted people to be reading serious fiction, but I look and I see Boston noir and Bronx noir and Brooklyn noir and every noir imaginable, Baghdad noir, Bogota noir, Jerusalem noir, extraordinary. So let's begin. You have a very particular definition of noir that I think is brilliant and cuts right through the red tape. Noir is about betrayal.
Yes, I think that's so true, and it's certainly borne out with most of the stories in prison noir.
It's especially borne out in prison noir because betrayal has often put these narrators where they are.
Yes, I was, when I assembled the stories, I had read very many stories, and what seemed to link them was this sense of profound shock, almost an ontological or metaphysical shock, that these people have undergone, sometimes at a quite young age, and they do feel betrayed either by an individual or by an institution or maybe by their own idealism, the misguided idealism.
These are writers who some of them have spent nearly half their lives in prison. And they're 15 writers who come from a limited number of institutions, although your call for stories was nationwide. What limited the response?
That's such a good question, Michael. I'm not even sure of the answer. Johnny Temple, who is the publisher and editor at Akashic Books, was in a sense my first editor. He sent out letters of query. He wrote to Penn. He wrote to people who have been teaching in prison programs. And I wrote to some people too. Of course, I wrote to Wally Lamb, who's very, very central to this. But we didn't get very many responses. It was so strange. There are entire states that either don't have any prison educational programs, or they just didn't want to cooperate. So disproportionately, we have wonderful stories from Michigan, but we have only one story from California, and I think we have not one story from New York State. Just amazing.
Of those who do respond, the revelation that people in prison who write may not be allowed to write about incarceration or prison life.
Exactly. It's like catch 22. What else would they write about? I mean, it's the reality of their lives, and yet they're not allowed to.
It's truly a nightmare. It's a form of censorship. But what struck me was frequently how good, mesmerizing, altering these stories are. And it's not necessarily because of the quality of the writing, although many of them are very well written. It's the degree to which they reveal a life that we can hardly imagine and that makes us feel, I think, very uncomfortable and bereft.
Yes, when I read these wonderful stories, some of these beautifully turned sentences, quite poetic insights, I think, you know, this person is in prison. It's just shocking. And Linda Marquand, who is in a women's facility, correctional facility in Michigan, is such a good writer. And I looked up in her biography. She is an English major who graduated with a BA from Penn State.
It's a remarkable story called Milk and Tea, because so many of these stories have the feel of memoir or autobiography. You can only hope that Linda Marquand's story is an invention, although one's fear is that it is not.
That's exactly how I feel.
It's so brilliantly told. And then when you look at the back of this book of 15 stories called Prison Noir, the writers have been asked for a biography. And having written a truly dark story of an abusive marriage that went to murder, she says, or it says of her, each day she tries to live by her father's teachings and be thoughtful, kind, and considerate toward others, regardless of her current incarceration at Women's Huron Valley Correctional Facility in Ypsilanti, Michigan. That feel, when you read the biography and see the pictures of the writers, of how much human yearning, as if she believes that we want to know that she follows her father's teachings.
I know, and she's very concerned for her sons. I think it's an achingly real autobiographical story. And when I read it, I felt such dismay, and I thought of the many, many, many women, and maybe men as well, who are in prison because of a crime of self-defense.
Yes. And then I read in your introduction that of the world's prison population, the United States locks up nearly 25%.
That's right. It's probably gone up, Michael, since I wrote this.
My. And, well, since you wrote this, one of the writers has been executed. Two of them have been freed. The publisher, Akashic Books, announces in its most recent catalog that they stand for the degentrification of fiction. And as I read the stories in Prison Noir, I thought how many of us no longer need the ecstatic writing of writing degree students, but need to see the world, a degentrified world in which so many of us live and struggle and fail to make do.
Yes, that's beautifully put. I feel exactly the same way. Those tend to be the people I write about.
Yes, they're the people you write about, but you've also gone and taught in prisons or visited writing programs in prisons.
Yes.
What has that shown you? What did you find?
I was teaching in the spring of 2011 at San Quentin, which of course is a maximum security prison for men in California. Well, that was fascinating. My husband, Charlie Gross, was also teaching. He's a scientist. He taught biology. Now, we were really, really impressed with the students. We did not really see a wide range of prisoners. We saw only the prisoners who were enrolled in the prison university program. So they were self-selected and also selected by the university. So we saw just a small fraction of the population in the prison. They tend to be a little older. They weren't young in their 20s. They tended to be maybe 30s. And my oldest student was 61. There were students in the program who already had BA degrees from colleges, from universities. But something happened in their lives. We all like to think that nothing like that would happen to us, but things happen and people behave impulsively and they wind up in prison.
I'm talking to Joyce Carol Oates, who has edited a book of fiction from Akashic Press of writing from prisoners, prison noir. Now, many people think that noir is more involved with murder and detection. But really, these writers and many noir writers, as you say, are writing about human betrayal. And since this is a time when lying and greed seem to characterize the way we live now, the stories seemed deeply real in ways that a lot of contemporary fiction does not to me anymore. Did you experience that too?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we can assume that these writers have not written very much. This is not, you know, their 15th volume. So they poured into these stories everything that's in their hearts. And it's very powerful. Now, whether they can keep writing is another question. I didn't begin to give them the kind of detailed criticism that I give to my students at Princeton University or at UC Berkeley or NYU, because the prison, the inmate students are so tremulous and insecure. Their writing represents such a relatively new thing in their lives that you can't overload them with criticism. Basically, I saw my role as encouragement, understanding and encouragement and empathy and allowing them to read their stories aloud so that they got some enthusiastic responses from the audience. But the students at San Quentin were so tremulous and insecure. Just coming to the class required a lot of courage. And as you probably know, the idea of being disrespected or losing face is very painful in a prison institution. They don't have anything else except their reputations.
I was involved a bit with a theater project in one of the charter schools here, and the young people, the young students, came to the rehearsals, enjoyed the rehearsals, wrote some of their own material, enjoyed rehearsing and performing it for one another. But when the day of performance came, more than half of them called in sick because were afraid of being laughed at or humiliated by their fellow students in the audience.
Yeah. And isn't that sad?
I think it's so revealing of the culture right now that the creative people who are barely being nurtured are afraid to reveal their inner spirit for fear of being ridiculed.
Well, in prison, men, these are all men at San Quentin, they have their own dignity and reputation. If you walk in the dining hall and bump somebody in the back of the head, he probably feels he has to try to kill you, you know, because it's so disrespectful. So I didn't feel comfortable at all criticizing the students, especially in front of one another. I never did that. It was mostly just admiring and supportive and enthusiasm and, you know, expressing that we were deeply moved or we laughed at the story and because of the humor. It was mostly just to give them an audience.
Well, I found that the stories printed now in a hardcover volume called Prison Noir were full of messages, like messages in a bottle or pleas, where the story tells you almost secretively, oh, listen, the best programs at the prison have all been shut down, have lost their funding. We have nothing. And it's done in a very indirect manner because they feel like messages that are trying to escape the gates of the prison.
Yes.
And I'm sure that many listeners would say, wait, they have biology classes and writing classes and theater classes. is this rehabilitation? Aren't we just there to make sure that they have a job when they get out? What do you think of the programs in prison, Joyce?
They're all different. The most developed and the longest running and most highly respected, I think, is a prison university program in California, in which a student can actually get a BA degree, the equivalent of a degree from maybe a junior college or a community college. And obviously, it's wonderful. Some of them can go right out to get jobs. Now, I can't speak for what it's like in Georgia or Alabama or Florida. I don't even want to think what it might be like. I know that Michigan has a good program, and I know that New York State has overall a good program. But not every prison, not every warden wants his prisoners to have outside visitors and have instructors. It's basically what the warden wants.
Well, one of the things we learn is that by ratting on another prisoner, a writer can be transferred to a prison that might have a program. In other words, the system encourages the kind of betrayal you spoke of as the essence of noir.
Yes.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Joyce Carol Oates about the book she's edited, Prison Noir, from Akashic Books. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Joyce Carol Oates. Joyce Carol Oates has a new book just out of her own stories called Lovely, Dark, Deep. But we are talking today about her collection she's edited called Prison Noir. It's a collection of truly compelling stories written by the incarcerated from within prison walls. Being the bookworm I am, I received your new book, Lovely, Dark, Deep, and read several of the stories. And the very first story, called Sex with Camel, is a story in which almost nothing happens. And yet it's an absolutely mesmerizing, jaw-dropping story. I think it may be modeled on a story by Flannery O'Connor about a woman and her young nephew. But I was so shocked by it, and I realized one of the things that a practiced writer learns is that not a lot has to happen in a story. These writers, they are knocking everything over. They want the story to be grisly and propulsive. And in a certain way, it reminds me of why I started to read fiction to begin with. That was a view of life, the life where you escape from the ordinary into an alternative reality.
Well, that's true, but I think also they're thinking of how they could interest their audience. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they're used to telling stories orally, and so they have to keep up that degree of suspense and excitement.
Now, how hard was it to edit these stories? Obviously, you don't want to correct everything because that is the language of the prison life. To what level does this degentrified fiction aspire?
Well, there may be a spectrum here from the stories at one end that were scarcely edited at all. I don't really remember. And then I know there are some stories because I see them in the volume, and I know they underwent quite a few revisions. I won't say which ones they are, but stories that were too long and that were repetitive. Maybe the reliance on the surprise ending was a little too much. I would write my notes, and they would be sent back to Brooklyn, where the publishing house is, And then they would go out to the prisoners. And so it was up to them to revise. But, you know, not to make a joke of it, but they do have plenty of time. So they didn't have any pressing engagements, and they could work on these stories at their leisure.
Fascinating. Did you send them copies of the books?
Oh, yes, I'm sure they have their copies.
Have you heard from them?
Yes, I have heard. They don't have email, they don't have access to a computer, but they would send a letter to the publishing house, and they'd send that to me. It's only been out recently, so I may have some coming. But I did get one touching letter.
I guess I entered an imaginative interaction with many of these writers between the things they write and the things they tell us in the biography note. One of them is very careful to set himself up above the conditions. He writes under a pseudonym. He tells us Stephen Gies is the pseudonym of a TV and music producer on prisonly hiatus.
I like that.
Yes.
On hiatus. I was wondering about him, yes. Uh-huh. And then the woman whose first name is Sin, she
yes.
said that she doesn't tolerate fools gladly, and she's sort of a recluse. She doesn't deal well with idiots, so she lives far away on the banks of a river. You wonder who this person is. She really sounds very intriguing.
Very intriguing. In a certain way, writers live such solitary lives, and we don't know about them. These writers and their characters burst from the page, but in ways that break your heart. It's a wrenching but thrilling experience. Do you consider any of these people new voices in that sense that we feel when we encounter a sensibility? Will we hear more from them?
Oh, yes. Several have said that they're writers and they're going to pursue writing as a career. When they're released from prison, one of them's getting out in December 2015, which is quite soon. And a couple others are already out. I think it's quite possible. Yeah, they have completed memoirs. Definitely.
I'm imagining Joyce Carol Oates assigning this book in a class at Princeton. Because I would like to see as many people reading it as possible. And I think it's worth reading. In fact, I think maybe it's the opposite. This isn't degentrified. By putting these prison writers in a volume, they've been gentrified. That is to say,
in a way, yeah.
Yeah, they've been brought to our attention. And what can I say but that they deserve our attention? For many reasons at once. Do you think that a book like this brought to university readers would be of interest?
It would probably be of interest to sociology students and anthropology students, and to some extent writing students. Now, I have always had students in my writing workshops who are teaching or giving literacy lessons at local facilities. So I've always had, you know, one or two or three students every semester who are going down to Trenton and they're teaching in a prison anyway. So this would be of great interest.
I think it's of enormous interest. You know, I'm speaking in a season of books that has included the works of Knausgaard, of the great Hungarian writer László Krásnahorkai, and yet I found, maybe because of the quality of the editing, the arrangement of the book, the stories seem to go from section to section to consider questions of justice, but I was willing to surrender the need for judgment and consider these as imaginative works of literature. Some of them not of the highest quality, but all of them, what? Caught in the human condition the way we ourselves are. And when Hamlet says about prison, then is the world one, It made me think, this is what it is at certain times, in certain conditions, to be alive without the power of volition, without the advantage of hope.
Yes, and it's touching that the last story in the collection is by a man who is no longer living because he's been executed.
Yes, and his last sentence is so astonishing. You know, you can hardly, you say it, I can hardly say
well,
it.
Well, I definitely wanted this story to be last. I saw the whole thing. It was horrible.
Yeah. You get to the end of this volume, and a man that you know from the introduction has been executed. I mean, it seems like a judgment on the world. I saw the whole thing. It was horrible. And it really, you know, it took my breath away.
Yes.
Wow. I've been talking with Joyce Carol Oates, editor of Prison Noir, published by Akashic Books. Thank you, Joyce, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Prison Noir at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director today is Ray Guarna. Special thanks to Jane Parshall. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Rachel Kushner is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.